Well, of the five topics, okay, so first of all, I'm Peter Hernis. I'm faculty member on the University of California, Davis. And I do river biogeochemistry research. I teach water quality classes. I teach classes on aqueous geochemistry, global biogeochemical cycles, things like that. That's what I do down there. And of the five topics I've done this week, this is probably the one that I like the most. It's my favorite topic because it's the closest to what I do. I think it's a nice, tidy piece of, it's a tidy scale, both time scale and landscape scale that I think that humans can relate to. It's something that's, you know, it's, I guess, maybe I should have said more about this yesterday at the forum, but, you know, it's an area for hope for me. It's something that I think that, you know, it's something that I relate well to. It's closely related to my research. My research, what I mostly do is look at dissolved organic matter. And if you can imagine, none of you guys have these tea tumblers around here, but if you can imagine these tea tumblers, you're sticking plant material in a thing of water, you're letting things leach out of there, you get lots of color in there, you get lots of interesting compounds that go into the tea. Depending on what kind of tea leaves you put in there, you get different kinds of dissolved organic matter. Well, the same thing is happening out in nature with leaves that come off of trees, bark that comes off of trees, soil organic matter, soils, any kinds of thing out there. You stick it in water and you let it sit there long enough and you'll get organic matter that comes out of there just like you get from tea. And so my job is to analyze the tea and tell stories. And so, you know, we take samples along a river, so you can take samples in headwaters and somewhere in the middle, and you know, work your way down, and you can go to the very end, and you measure this dissolved organic matter tea, and you look at how the composition changes from one place to another, and you look at how the concentration changes from one place to another, and so my job is to tell a story about, you know, how are the sources changing, different, you know, how are the sources changing along the river, what kind of processes are happening along the river that change the composition or change the sources that degrade it, that add to it, what comes out at the very end of the river, and how does that relate to all the different processes that are happening up in the watershed, up in the catchment. That's my job. It's sort of a catchment scale process, and mostly what we're going to talk today about our catchment scale processes in terms of pollutants. I don't generally deal with pollution in my research. I mostly just teach it and work it. But a lot of what I'm doing when trying to understand these processes that happen to dissolved organic matter are the same kinds of things that come into play when we talk about pollutants and how pollutants interact with things in nature, how pollutants get degraded in nature, and the way that ultimately the water bodies clean themselves. That's kind of the point of this topic. But if you can imagine, you know, like a small agricultural catchment where the water that comes in at the top is flushed out in about 7 days. If you get into a big system like the Amazon, it might take about a month or so for the water that gets at the top to get down to the mouth and get out. I mean, that's stuff that we can relate to. You know, again, I have a hard time relating to things that occur over 500 years, let alone 1,000 or 100,000 or a million or a billion years. I just can't relate to that, and so I'm not a geologist, because, you know, it's fascinating, but I can't understand it. I just can't comprehend that kind of a time scale. But rivers speak to me in the most, I guess that's it took me a long time to find that niche in my career. I started off, what did I start off? I started off doing, I have a degree in chemical oceanography, and we were doing, you know, and chemical oceanography involves some very, very long time scales as well. It takes like 500 to 1,000 years for the water to completely turn itself over, the whole circulation pattern of the ocean. That's hard for me to comprehend. We talk about sedimentation. I guess what I did my master's on involved particles fluxing down through the water column and getting buried in the sediments. And they get buried in the sediment. That sediment travels along the ocean floor, gets subducted, comes back up and gets weathered. Well, that's hundreds of millions of years. I don't relate very well to that either. And so it took me a long time to kind of work my way into rivers. I can handle something that happens over the course of a week, or something that happens over the course of a month, or several years, something like that too. So it's the right scale for me. And I think that know, I can relate to it, and that's why I love this topic so much, is that a lot of what we talk about and a lot of what we deal with in water quality is that same kind of thing, processes that happen over the course of 7 days to a month, maybe, or years. It happens in my lifetime. I can relate to it. So let me just go talk a little bit about this, about the history here. So 1972... Water Act was put in place, and this was largely, you know, we'd recognized for decades that that our waters were dirty and they were getting worse. The Clean Water Act, kind of like the tipping point for when the Clean Water Act was passed, was when a river in Ohio literally lit on fire, caught fire and burned because there was just so much pollutants on it. I can't pronounce it. It's like the Cuyahoga or something river, some an Indian name. It's like trying to get it, you know, coming to Washington and trying to pronounce the various names of the places out on the West Coast, like Squim.
Right.
Anyway, it's one of those kind of rivers, but it literally caught on fire, and that's the one I think that finally pushed people over the edge, and they enacted this Clean Water Act in order to try to clean up our nation's waters, because it was clear that it was getting worse. Something had to be done. So the first thing that they put in place was something called the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. I had to look this up. I mean, it's commonly referred to as just, or you know, as the NPDES, which, you know, that's just, you know, I had to look this up today because I can never remember what that means. It's a permit system. And the idea was to go after the lowest hanging fruit that they could. So this NPDES permit system was targeted toward point sources, factories, wastewater treatment plants, small animal, or confined animal feeding operations are defined as a point source. So like dairy farms or pig farms or chicken farms are defined as point sources. And so the idea is that in order for these things to be in operation, they have to be permitted. They have to apply for a permit, they have to get a permit. As the first cut, they used something that was called best available technology. So the idea was, you know, we've got these different ways of trying to clean up the water. Just take the best ones that are out there right now. When you build your factory, you got to stick them on the end of your tailpipe, and let's see what happens to the water. And so, you know, it worked to some extent. That, you know, our water bodies started to improve. They started to get better because we were cleaning this thing up. But it wasn't fixing the problem all the way. This wasn't going to get it done all by itself. So the next cut that they implemented was, okay, I should spell it out before I spit acronyms at you. Water was the implementation of water quality standards. And under this regulation here, what comes out of your tailpipe has to meet certain water quality criteria. It's not good enough to put the best available technology. If your best available technology does not get the water to comply with water quality standards, you have to do more. And so this was the second attempt here to try to get this thing to work with point sources. So.
And did another bad thing occur for them to implement that, the water quality?
No, I think at this point there was enough, you know, there was enough, I mean, this law had been passed, there was enough teeth, there was enough interest that, you know, that, I mean, there may have been environmental groups that sued for it, but we'll get to that story in a minute or so. But in this case, it just this was helping, but it wasn't getting the job done. There were still too many impaired water bodies at the, you know, coming off of these tailpipes. So they put in this place, this water quality standard thing, and it, of course, it improved things, but it still didn't fix it. Under this Clean Water Act, every 2 years has to compile a list of impaired water bodies.
Is that still true now?
Yep, it is. And this is, these are called 303 D lists. So if you're curious to know about water bodies near where you live that you want to, you know, want to know which ones are polluted, you would just search for your state and 303 D lists, and I guess a specific water body, you can find out whether it's on that list and what the impairment is. And so this list has been growing because it takes a long time for them to get water bodies analyzed and tested. Right now they're up to about 71,000 water bodies in the U.S. that are listed as impaired on 303D lists, and it's been growing. And so it was clear that this idea or this approach of going after the point sources wasn't getting the job done. In the late 80s, there were several environmental groups that sued the EPA because there was another provision in the Clean Water Act for dealing with non-point sources. These were all point sources. They're coming out of a pipe. They're easily regulated. Non-point sources are things like septic systems all around Hood Canal, for instance, or around lakes. Septic systems are non-point sources. It leaches into the ground. Once it leaves that septic system, it gets really hard to track where it's coming from. That's a non-point source. And so in the late 80s, the environmental organizations sued the EPA and said, you know, look, this, you've got the provisions in the Clean Water Act for dealing with and enforcing non-point source pollutions as well. You got to do it. It took about 10 years for that to work its way through the courts. And eventually the courts, of course, decided that, yes, they really do need to deal with these things. So in the late 90s, they started to implement ways of trying to deal with the non-point sources. And so at this point, I was planning to have people divide up into small groups and kind of discuss amongst themselves how you would deal with non-point sources. And I guess we could still do that, like a group of three there and a group of three there, and you can compete against each other and see who comes up with the best plan for coming dealing with non-point sources. Because it's not, it's kind of a tricky situation. So I guess let's do that for right now. Just
shut it down.
Put your heads together and decide. I mean, you know, we're talking
shut
about.
Shut them all down. There we go.
I don't know.
If it would be helpful, I'll start listing a few non-point sources up here just to kind of get something you can focus on if you want.
Lawns.
Yeah. So those are three big ones. Those are kind of like the three big ones. Here's another good one. Runoff from roads.
It is true.
Yes.
Roads and parking lots. Atmospheric deposition.
Just runoff. Runoff.
All through the Seattle area. All through the Seattle area.
Wherever they fancy. I know that. Right there. They just use it as a disposal.
A lot of people have to remove their septic system.
They forget that's
too far. But
too far.
They have to pump the stuff up to and then have a huge drain field. So the standards have really changed, but I'm sure it's still I don't know what comes out is.
Hopefully it could be used as a fertilizer, though, too.
What?
So, the septic could be used as a fertilizer. I've been to a reception, a water treatment plant. It's pretty neat when they go, it comes out of there. It's actually pretty amazing.
I assume, if we have a septic system, you also have to pump them once in a while. And I don't know what they do with that sludge, I suppose.
They take it to the sewage treatment plant.
Yes, those trailers are going to this actual river.
But no, my friend that was in dairy business, they put all of their sewage manure. And put it in a big huge can. And I don't know if they process it any, everything they would.
Spread it on the field.
And, you know, it was a bit of a fuss when the days that they were spreading on the field. So then they had to start plowing it. Big huge tank with blades on the back, followers, or
washed off
air pollution.
Yeah.
But it was air pollution that started the biggest fuss because the neighbors didn't like all that.
Living next to the sewage dump.
I don't know if how big this is, but streams, the state is buying 16 or 20 feet, I think it is.
Of section to the stream?
The stream, back the farmer.
Oh.
At least, I don't know if it's a long-term lease or if it's a, but anyway, the farmers get paid for leaving foul on where they go, so they can't just leave the foul, they have to plant some kind of.
First of all,
we have a very bottom. I would imagine there's gold on this plant because there are certainly something. But that's not every creek, but I suppose where there is water flowing.
Yeah, one of the major, like the, be one of the ones over there where issues are.
I was thinking of 16 feet, but that's not really very much.
That's not very far past.
No, so maybe it's
I got into a real heated argument of recreational use. This guy was walking his dog and picked up the dog through it down the sperm drain.
That's not exactly.
You know, you've got a lot of that flat out wrong. It's in the sewer.
Wow.
Yeah, the sewer that runs directly to the river.
Oh, yeah.
Not the sewer that's going to go to any cream. Oh, no, it's all those.
Or it might be going to some lake.
Yeah,
kids
question. It got to 23 feet.
He was adamant that they all put it into those. All sewers are treated
this way for a few weeks.
Farm sewers are.
Why do people stay there?
You guys have some suggestions for me yet? Do you have some suggestions?
Yeah.
We're trying.
How would you do that? How would you go about these point sources? What would you do? Our non-point sources, sorry. I mean, if it helps, one here, and how would you go after any one of those things?
And we just kind of ended up feeling it's almost impossible to penalize people because it's just so widespread. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's education at a very, start with education. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Okay, so education is what on it?
They stopped selling the high phosphorus content fertilizers that people were dumping on their lawn and driveways.
Okay, so a little bit of regulation of source.
Yeah, and more regulation of the state and federal land for people who still can use it for managing whatever.
I think this is, I don't know how effective this is, but I just heard about it in Minnesota. And streams, small streams going through a farm, there the government is buying a strip along each side that has to be left. Need to plant it to grass or something, I imagine the government has to keep the farmer from farming right up and dumping the fertilizer right into the
All right, so riparian zones, we'll definitely come back to that one later on here as we go. Any other thoughts about the actual regulation and how you would do this? How would you do the education component? Let's talk about that one for a second. Because there are some very interesting ideas that have come out of this.
Well, you know, I don't think people knew that if they did this fertilizer on their lawns, that they were really, it was going to be run off and go into the streams. They just didn't know. And I hope that once they do know, they will not use those things anymore. But
so would you go around door to door and knock on people's doors and then hit them with you?
Would you go to Fox News and let them know about you?
If you put it on Fox News, people will spread more.
Sure. Could there be a notice put in people's
and the bills, the amount of bills.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
A little notice that kind of comes out. What goes into your storm sewer?
Yeah, I do read those things.
I think in our city and suburb of Minneapolis, they always get, when we get the water bill, we also get a newsletter.
Right.
I think they've been pretty good at passing out information.
Right.
And of course, in Minnesota, I don't know if the rest of you in Minnesota, but they outlawed phosphorus.
But I'm just one person. It's not really going to matter if I change there, you know, if other people change, I'll let them. So, but I'm just one person. What's the big deal? You know, I know it's a bad thing, but you know, if enough of my neighbors take care of it, I can keep doing what I'm going to do. How do you put some teeth behind it?
There's more American water spread on our lawns than there is on all of our farms.
Isn't that something?
It's ridiculous.
They do start at a young age now. I mean, my kids get a lot of education, whether it's from the alms near the zoo or whatever, or school, than I did, and it seems to continue.
But it's a hard thing. Until you make it personal, people are just not going to, you know, you'll get some. You'll get some because there are people who want to do it because it's the right thing to do. But until you make it personal, until they have a personal stake in it, it's really hard to get at this thing. So education, one of the things that's been done with education, so agriculture is obviously a big contributor to non-point source pollution. And for a long time, the EPA or the environmental groups have been just wanting these agriculture to be regulated. And so since 1972, there's been a provision that's been used called ag waivers, recognizing that, you know, if you just go hard after agriculture, you're going to drive them out of business. You know, you cannot go after them, and you cannot stick thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of dollars of things on them, you know, because it just won't work. So ag waivers have been in place for a long time. Well, environmental organizations have been suing about that as well now, that, you know, these ag waivers, you know, you can't just leave them there in place because agriculture is responsible, like, for four of the top five pollutants, four of the top five water body impairments comes off of agriculture. So you can't do that forever. And so what they've been doing now is they'll still issue ag waivers, but they'll only issue ag waivers, at least in California, I don't know if this is going around the rest of the country, if you join sort of a coalition of farmers. Or, I guess, watershed, I'll call them catchment. I've been trying to work over to the word catchment. And so the idea here is that, you know, you can get your ag waiver, but you got to be part of this coalition. You got to talk with each other, you got to work with each other, and so that they decided, you know, that this is a great way of trying to get some of that education component in. It's a way of trying to make it more personal, is to, you know, you've got to be in conversation with your neighbors about you know, what's coming off your land, what kind of things you do. And so this is one of the levels where they're trying to make it a little bit more personal, where they're trying to get that education to be more tailored to the people who actually have a chance of making a difference and implementing it. So this is sort of one of the positive things that I think is developed in terms of the education component right now, trying to get people on board in order to do these things. Yeah.
I don't know how they enforce it, but I know if you're a farmer in Minnesota anyway, I suppose it's all over, you can't spread fertilizer and bug control without having a license.
For sure. There's permits for a lot of those different things that you have to, you know, nutrient management.
You got to go to school to get this, and you can't just go down and pay your fee, you have to take classes.
Yeah.
I would see that there might be a lot of conflict in this catchment. For example, Washington State, we have the wheat growers, and then we have the wine people, mm-hmm. and they fight over the water.
Yeah. So, no, for sure. Let me just kind of give an example here too. So, in California, and I know it's different in different places, but in California, the typical farmer will put about, depending on the crop, 150 to 300, maybe sometimes more than 300 pounds of nitrogen per acre for fertilization. It depends on if they're, depends on the crop, depends on if they're single cropping, double cropping, triple cropping. In some places you can actually get away with triple cropping in California just because of the climate that's there. 27 pounds per acre. If you go over by 27 pounds per acre what your plants take up, that is enough to cause your groundwater to exceed the maximum contamination level for drinking water purposes.
Wow. They don't work close to it.
So you can imagine, it's like, how do you manage that amount of fertilizer? You have that narrow little window there. It's like in these fields there where you're trying to put 300, that's 10%. Differences the water is controlled pretty carefully there because it's primarily irrigation. But you don't know the sun, the climate, the wind, you don't know all these other factors that come into your year that cause variability in your crop yields. And unless you can predict very precisely what your crop yield is going to be ahead of time to know how much nitrogen you're going to need in order to get that yield, it's pretty easy to miss. And if you're a farmer, nitrogen is pretty cheap. Are you gonna go under what you think you need and just bank on having? No, you're gonna try to provide an excess because you want the maximum yield you can get out of that depending on what the climate is. But that's what they're faced with right now in terms of violating the nitrate and the nutrient standard right now is this 27 pounds. And that's just for drinking water. If you're talking about environmental impacts, it has to be less than that. Just spreading 27 excess pounds per acre and letting that get into your groundwater and getting into your streams, that's too much. But so for drinking water, that's the threshold that they have. For ecological purposes, for environmental purposes, it has to be less than that. So you need a master's degree or you need something in order to be a farmer these days in order to be able to handle this kind of thing here and be able to do just the nutrient management aspect of it. Anyway, so what has been put in place here and through the Clean Water Act is something called the Total Maximum Reload. And this is a rate. And basically it says how much how does a water body handle itself? How does a water body clean itself of nitrates? How does a water body clean itself of pesticides? How does it get rid of metals? How does it get rid of sediments? How does it get rid of all these different things here? Because unless a water body has a way of getting rid of it, this concept here doesn't work. And so the concept is here, we can put in, we can allow certain kind of pollution into these water bodies, but it cannot exceed the natural rate at which the water body can handle it. And so, the formula that's put in place or that's used for this looks like this. It's point sources. Non-point sources plus margin of safety. And these TMBLs, these are a catchment scale
it's a holistic way. So we look at the whole catchment, and we analyze the whole catchment to try to understand what the point sources are, what the non-point sources are, what a reasonable margin of safety is. We have to look at the whole catchment to understand how much of this, you know, what is a natural rate at which the catchment can handle this pollutant. And then all these people have to duke it out. There will be a certain amount that's assigned to the point source. There will be a certain amount that's assigned of this, the rate that will be assigned to the non-point sources. And now it's personal. Now it's not enough just to, I mean, it's certainly they're going to work with each other and educate each other in order to try to come up with a way of reducing their point source or the non-point sources. But they have a stake and they have a target. They have something that they have to meet. And so this is the way that this has been implemented. This is the way that they're trying to go after these non-point sources now, and the way that they're trying to put a little bit of teeth and make it personal and make it regulated. So I'd like for you guys to do a little bit more talking in your small groups, very small groups, both of them. And let's just start with kind of an easy one. Just discuss amongst yourself, how do rivers clean themselves? And if you want to speak and think about specific pollutants, I mean nutrients, pathogens, sediments, metals. Those are some of the big dogs right now in rivers. Just think about the different ways that you can think of about how a river cleans itself that feeds into the
plants. They take up a lot of that.
The agitation,
nutrients, pathogens, and the metals too.
So you're gonna have that natural.
Are sequestered from some of those plants.
Not to some, but obviously.
Rivers, at least they flush themselves.
They flush themselves through the water.
But the stuff that's less left there. Savings in cost, they send it by barge rather than
Yes, redhead.
Truck, you know, that's the ultimate.
And then non-native species.
Send a truck down.
I'm gonna have the alligators that take them north, right?
There, but.
You know, if they just could enforce no row crops when the grade is greater than 2% or something. Leave that for the alfalfa and the clovers. Put their row crops on the flatter terrain.
But we like to.
Well.
And we like to drive our cars, so. But, you know, that's farming practices, they do, you know.
We want the answers from you, please.
Okay, they're ready. Well, that's fine. No, so what have you come up with?
Well, we figured with rivers, because they're constantly in motion, you've got the agitation and there's aeration that will take place.
So what would aeration do?
The aeration would probably cause some things to evaporate and to leach out. It would introduce, you know, new oxygen in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that could help. And plus with the constant flow, you're diluting. So you've got a dilution.
Okay, so you've got elements of dilution.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't always the greatest thing, but it is a way of doing things. So you've got dilution going on. What else do you got going on?
And we also carry, the rivers carry stuff with them and then drop them.
So you got flushing.
Possibly the natural filtration of the plants in the body of water, using whatever nutrients they can use.
Okay, so you've got...
Maybe breaking that down.
Move the problem to the Gulf of Mexico then.
Photosynthesis, mm-hmm. So that one uses up nutrients. Flushing will take care of a lot of the different ones. Anything else that you can think of? Anything that you guys in particular thought of as mechanisms for rivers that to kind of self-clean?
The wetlands that are full of growing wonderful plants that are sucking the nutrients and the pathogens out of the water.
Okay, so wetlands.
Intentionally, not.
Is flushing a fair thing to think about? Because all you do is move it all down into the ocean then, isn't it?
Well, for the purposes of looking at the 303D list, if it cleans it up, you get that water body off the list.
It's amazing.
But
put it in
you're
your
just moving, you're just moving the problem, aren't you?
Wow.
Well, okay, so this is a genuine, I mean, this is a genuine thing here of interest. I mean, for the purposes of, like, in California, there's the city of Stockton that sits way inland, and they've dug out a deep watership canal to it. They took a bed that was, you know, like maybe 7 feet deep, and they put it down to 30 to 35 feet deep. And in the summertime, the flows, when they drop, they go so slowly through this deep watership canal that all the oxygen gets used up at depths there, and fish can't pass. And it becomes kind of a toxic place for any fish to be. And so one of the solutions is, well, increase the flow. There's a very clear cutoff. I mean, you can make a nice diagram between how many days, you know, whether you've got low oxygen in that thing related to the flow. If you increase the flow, you increase the aeration, you keep things moving, and you've solved your problem. So, I mean, in some ways, you know, yeah, the flushing thing is a legitimate solution. In that case, you're really not pushing any problem on anywhere else. You're just increasing the oxygenation and making it habitable for fish. But this interaction thing with wetlands here, this is a critical one here too, because it does go after nutrients, it goes after pathogens, it collects sediments. It can actually work on metals as well, that there's metals, I don't want to get too far into the chemistry of metals, but there's these redox transformations that happen in metals. Not all forms of selenium are toxic. Some forms are, some forms aren't. When you pass the toxic form of selenium into a wetland, it converts it into a non-toxic form. So it can handle things. If you, on the other hand, if you take mercury, the less toxic form, which is usually floating down the river, you stick it in a wetland, it'll turn it into a more toxic form. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword depending on what kind of things you've got going in your system there. But wetlands are a great way of working with all of these things, working with pesticides. It's a way of, you know, these wetlands. And so
wetlands are obviously a key component of these rivers, and that's one of the reasons why it's so tragic that we've lost 90-some percent of our wetlands. In the state of California, I think 95% of the original wetlands are gone, and there's only about 5% of them remaining along these rivers. And so wetlands are a way that that nature had of really taking care of itself, especially in these rivers. Let's see, some other types of things, depending on the river, there's a lot of things like pesticides that can be surface active, and they will bond onto sediments. The sediments will drop out at the low points of the rivers, and they'll just get buried. And so burial is one way that a river can kind of clean itself of some of these things. There's PCBs are something that tend to be very sticky and clingy to sediments. And so there's a lot of places in rivers, especially out east, where you've got these big sediment beds, where there's PCBs down below, and they're there, and there's some people that want to actually clean them up, but the mere process of going and dredging them up and trying to get at them and to remove them is actually worse than just leaving them alone. Where they are right now, they're buried, they're not really interacting with things very much too, so there's kind of an interesting dynamic. But burial is another potential one for dealing with different kinds of pollutants. Okay, so let's think about a more interesting case. I would rather regulate a river than a body just because of that flushing potential. What about a lake with no outlet?
With no outlet? Oh, no.
So what kind of processes come into play for a lake with no outlets? How does it clean itself?
Evaporates.
And then it becomes more processes.
There's like more burial.
Yeah. Well,
you know, wildlife.
Well, clearly, yeah, burial is another one of those things that you're going to have that might come into play.
We've got examples. We've got Double Lake. We've got Salt Lake. We've got the Dead Sea.
Uh huh. Yeah. No, I mean there are lots of places that are lakes with no outlets, but there are still processes if you give it enough time. I mean, it's you can, if you shut off all the anthropogenic pollution in these things, they will fix themselves.
Yeah. So the bacteria that's in there will work on certain.
What's that?
Is there a possibility with the bacteria present in the water to work on it to break down certain?
Sure. Yeah. So bacterial degradation becomes important. So this would be, any kinds of pesticides or, I guess solvents, organic pollutants. That's something that would definitely happen from bacterial degradation. Again, burial is an important thing. A lot of these metals will eventually glom onto sediments and drop down and get buried. Nutrients, how do you get rid of nutrients?
Animals and birds? No.
No, not so much.
Fish? No.
Algae? The weeds, the seaweed, the...
Yeah, so nutrients, you would probably, you get algal blooms. Which will grow on these things.
Okay.
The algal blooms will eventually die, sink, and you're kind of back to this whole burial thing again.
Hmm.
I mean, burial seems to be a pretty important thing. Mm-hmm. Another one that happens in these natural waters is sunlight.
Okay.
Sunlight, your arms get tan and
so
over time your skin looks kind of trashed out from getting lots of sunlight. I mean, it's just interacting with the organics in your skin. It's the same kind of thing there. There's processes of photodegradation. And it's amazing how efficient the sun is at being able to break down and degrade colored organic matter. Again, going back to these teas, I mean, you can make sun tea by letting it out, keeping it out in the sun and letting everything cook. But if you leave it out there long enough, the sun will start to bleach it all and take all that color away. And that's a process of photooxidation or photodegradation. And so this works on pesticides, it works on solvents, organic pollutants, and things like that too.
There'd be some minimal
dilution with rainfall, but in winter areas with the winter runoff, mm-hmm. and that sort of adds to these bodies of water. Or
I mean, so there is another one. So a lake with no outlet, that's kind of a little bit of a misnomer. Because that's just assuming that it's collecting in a bowl that's impervious. And so you actually have interaction with, where am I going to put it? Nobody's taking notes, so I could just scribble wherever I want to. Interaction with groundwater. So these lakes are actually a little bit, are flow-through system to some extent as well. That you've got these lakes that are flowing down into the groundwater. They're not really just sitting there in a bowl. So you've got interaction with groundwater where, you know, it is to some extent it's pushing down into the ground, and so there is a little bit of a flushing effect. There also happens to be a lot of activity, and you know, we tend to think of the benthos or the sediment layers as being kind of pretty sterile, but actually there's a lot of biological activity that happens in the benthic area too. So even in a river, you'll get they call it spiraling effect, where the water will spiral down into the benthic layers, into the sediments. There's lots of bacteria that are clinging to particles in there that'll work on the water. Water comes back out again, it comes back down in. And so in a river, they talk about nutrient spiraling and carbon spiraling as the water goes down into the sediments, interacts, comes back out, goes back down in, comes back out. So you get that same kind of thing that's happening in these lakes as well, that you get that same kind of interaction with the biological benthic environment, working on all these different things and kind of cleaning them up, stripping them out, changing forms. If you've had any kind of wetlands, again, around these water bodies there, you're going to get that same kind of effect where, you know, the wetlands will do all the same kinds of things in a river or in a lake that they will do in a river. It's a place for processing things. Let me see, what else do I have here on my what-ifs? So you talked about the... we'll skip that one. We talked about pushing the problem onto like the hypoxic zones in the Gulf of Mexico, but we'll skip that for right now. So,
who oversees? Who inspects?
So this is the EPA. This is all under the jurisdiction of the EPA, and I guess I could say a little bit about that as well too. So there's a federal EPA. Environmental Protection Agency, and that's organized into regions, which is organized into a state. So each there will be a state EPA, and within the state EPA, there's these local water quality control boards. And so this is the level at which most of the regulation happens, is at the local level. You know, the standards that are put in place are probably developed up at the federal level, but it's the local water quality control boards that actually do the enforcement of these things. So all these processes here, so a scientist is going to go out and look at all these different things, the flushing rates, photodegradation, bacterial degradation, deposition, interaction, all these different things. A scientist will come out there and try to determine what this total maximum daily load is for a lake, for a river, for any of these water bodies. And then it's up, at that point, up to policy people to put in place some sort of an allocation. So science determines, TMDL, policy determines allocation. And you can imagine that's not necessarily an easy process. I mean, you're sort of, in some sense, pitting the point source folks against the non-point sources. So at some point, they just have to jump in there and make the decision of how to do this. But that's only one part. So we've been talking about, so we talk about allocation of this, but this
is not a static number. There's ways of changing that left side of the equation. There's a lot of an obsession about the right side of the equation because that's where the rubber meets the road, but there's room to work on the left side. So what are the different ways that you work on that left side? What are the ways that you could actually improve or increase the healing, the natural healing capacity of a water body, so that you could actually, in theory, get by with the levels of pollution that you put in place? You've already hit on two big ones here within the conversation of the session, so you just have to have a decent memory. You don't have to think about it, you just have to have a memory.
You just tell us.
Thank you for saying it.
That works too.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's Friday. I don't know. What does Friday around here mean anyway?
Thank God it's Friday. Oh.
Yeah, I guess there's sort of a weekend around here too, isn't there? Well, so the first one, I mean, is pretty obvious. Wetland remediation.
Okay.
Wetlands do a lot of good things for you, so in terms of water quality. And so one of the obvious ways of dealing with this, if you're just not able to get it done within the natural or for whatever it is, there's the potential for adding in wetlands, cleaning up the water. Yeah.
Does that matter whether it's man-made wetland or natural?
It doesn't matter.
Down by where I work, they actually made a huge wetland because there's, in Renton, there's a river that runs through the city, and they actually made a man-made wetland.
Yeah, absolutely. You can stick in. You can construct wetlands.
So what qualifies a wetland? What are the restrictions to make it a wetland? Because I'm just thinking.
The restrictions on it? Well, it depends on where you are. In California, it's kind of interesting. The biggest restriction for putting wetlands in the Delta area is the Department of Pest Control. Because wetlands are a mosquito breeding ground, and so the Department of Pest Control actually has a big stick on regulating what you can do with your wetlands and how many of these suckers you can put in. That's a little bit weird, but that's how much clout they have down there.
How big does it have to be to make it a wetland?
I'm not sure about the size, but I mean anything. I don't think it has to be very big. I don't know. That's a good question. I should take a look and see if there is actually a size.
Rain gardens seem to be the wave of the future. People aren't letting all their water go flushing down the streets and
mm-hmm.
save it and get some good out of it mm-hmm. close to home.
Yeah, you know, cisterns and things like that, collecting water in a cistern. Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, wetlands is a big one there, that if you can add wetlands to your water body, whether it's a lake or a river or some kind of interaction, it's a great way. So that there's a river that crosses the border, it comes from Mexico and flows into the United States. I think it's in Arizona, it might be California, I forget. Maybe it's California, it's called the New River. And when it comes across the border, it's so polluted and infested with industrial wastes and nutrients and pathogens and things like that. There are a lot of illegal immigrants who try to swim down the river in order to get over the border, and they end up getting very, very sick from it. And there's pictures of cars that have been submerged in these things that where the paint literally gets stripped off the cars. So this comes over the border there, and you know, we have to deal with it. And so one of the ways that they deal with it is they run it through wetlands. They've constructed a series of wetlands for this river to pass through. And it's amazing. I mean, it cleans up the sediments, it cleans up the pathogens, it cleans up all these solvents and things like that too. So that's one of the ways that they've managed to make this, clean this river up, is just by running it through wetlands. And it does a great job on it. The other one that you hit on earlier here was the concept of riparian zones. So much of the chemistry of a river and what comes into a river is determined in that last several tens of feet or whatever. It's the area that surrounds the river that really determines what gets into the river. And so, you know, you're right, when the farms go right up to the river, it's very easy for nutrients and pesticides and things like that to just flow straight off. and go into the river and cause big problems. When you put these, if you implement riparian zones and you make it, you know, acting as a filter, and there's a little bit of a wetland component to these things too along the edge, right at the interface between the land and the river, there's, you know, lots of characteristics of wetlands there. We've got some vegetation and things like that too. And so implementing these riparian zones is another way of trying to increase this natural healing capacity of the watershed, of the catchment, and keeping these rivers clean. So those are kind of like the two big sticks, the two big tools that are used for most kinds of things. Like I said, for unique cases like oxygen depletion, you can increase the flow and try to do flush things. And so there's some more specific things that you can do depending on what your pollutants are. But these are the two things here that are primarily used in for to try to bump up this left side. So we're close to the time here. I guess as a final thought here, sort of the focus of my sessions this week has been time and our relationship to time. And just like with all of these different environmental issues here, our ability, you know, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to get away from the anthropocentric focus on time. You know, the time scales that are relevant to us. This concept of TMDL and trying to understand how water bodies heal themselves is all about us getting in sync with how nature functions and the time scales that are relevant to nature. It's a focus on nature's time scales and not ours. And I think that that's the key thing for us in any of these environmental issues is our ability to get out of our world and kind of get in sync with the natural world. And if we can do that on any environmental issue, it will do loads to improve the situation. So unless you have any questions or comments, that's what I've got for this one.